Interview with Paul Mahoney, March 30th, 2011, in Charlottesville, Virginia, by Kenneth Durr. Well, let's go back to the beginning.
Okay.
I noticed that you started as an engineering major in college.
That's right, yeah.
Which seems a little unusual for someone who came through your career track.
No, actually, I don't think so at all. Engineering is a problem-solving discipline. I think law is a problem-solving discipline. And I think the only barrier sometimes that engineers find in transitioning into law is writing skills. But I was fortunate and had some very good instructors in college, both in writing and in the analytical part of engineering. So I think it was actually very good preparation for law.
So how far along were you at MIT when you started to think about law?
Really not until just about my senior year. And I was having a little bit of a concern about career choices because I had done engineering work over the summers. And while I liked the intellectual challenge of my coursework, I just didn't really find the work that I was doing over the summers to be all that personally exciting and fulfilling. So as it just so happened, I had been reading a number of works of history and biography in my spare time and just kept finding these lawyers popping up all over the place doing interesting things and decided that maybe I would give that a shot. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was an especially careful process, as might not be all that surprising when we're talking about someone who's whatever I was, 21 years
right.
old or something like that. But in any event, I'm glad I did it.
So, you went to Yale.
That's right.
Tell me a little bit about the program as you found it when you got there. Who were some of the leading lights in the law program there?
So Yale at the time I was there really had a reputation as a place that was halfway between a standard legal education and a kind of free-floating PhD program. Obviously, as you probably know, an awful lot of its graduates end up becoming academics. I think in my class, I'd probably estimate that something like 20% of my classmates ended up teaching somewhere or other. I was very lucky at Yale because they have, like we do here at Virginia, one of your first year classes is in a very small group. And my small group professor was George Priest, who was at that time an up and coming young leader in the law and economics movement. I found that way of organizing my thinking about law to be quite powerful and persuasive, and so George was someone who had a tremendous influence on my intellectual development as a lawyer. I then took a course from Guido Calabresi, who also was a very important figure in law and economics, and that just furthered my interest in law and economics as a methodology. I didn't end up moving into the same substantive areas of interest. George Priest was an antitrust and sort of regulated industries scholar, and Guido is a little harder to pigeonhole, but his most famous law and economics work was in torts, and those were not areas that I ended up moving into, but the methodology I found quite powerful.
Yeah, I think it might have been Frank Easterbrook who said that the Chicago School was really at Yale for a period of time, and it sounds like this might have been that period of time.
Certainly, there were some very strong law and economics people on the Yale faculty at that point.
And you touched on one of my questions, which was antitrust. My understanding is that antitrust was really one of the areas in which law and economics worked itself out.
Exactly.
To a great degree early
exactly
on.
Exactly so.
Did you make a conscious decision to look elsewhere? Did you work on antitrust?
No. I actually took just about every antitrust course that was available in law school, and I thought it was really interesting, and that was what I planned to make my practice. And then I ended up taking evidence, of all things, from Ralph Winter, who had already been appointed to the bench by President Reagan. And I was unbelievably lucky that I ended up, he ended up hiring me to clerk for him, which was just probably one of the great sort of pieces of luck of my entire career. He had been a corporate law scholar of considerable prominence and success, and also was interested in securities law, which he taught occasionally at Yale. He didn't during the time I was there, so I didn't have the chance to take it. That's another of the lovely ironies of this. I never took a course in securities regulation. But I found myself during my clerkship just spending an immense amount of time talking about corporate and securities law with Ralph Winter. And that really persuaded me that that was where my intellectual interests were going to lie. I was also aided in that because as a after my second year in law school, so I guess just before I took Ralph's evidence course, I was a summer associate at Sullivan and Cromwell, worked on some securities deals, and talking with Ralph about the intellectual context of that and having seen a little bit of it in the real world really sort of lit the fire.
I want to get back to that in a minute. Let's talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of working in the Second Circuit
as a
clerk. How did Judge Winter sort of divide up the work, and how much did he give you to do?
His chambers, certainly at that point in time, because he was quite new on the bench. I was one of his third set of law clerks, and the chamber still ran fairly informally. It was as much an ongoing seminar as anything else. All four of us, the three law clerks and Ralph, and by the way, we called him Ralph, just spent a lot of time each day debating and talking about the cases that were on the docket. The clerks, of course, like in any chambers, did the bench memos that prepared the judge for a sitting, and we did first drafts of opinions, but Ralph had a very strong sense of where he wanted the analysis to go, and so oftentimes you would try something out, and he'd come back and say, "Let's move it in this direction." And so there was a lot of back and forth.
Just verbally with him, or would you take a pencil to?
Some of each. Yeah. He certainly would sit down with the blue pencil and do a lot of actual revising, but he would also just sit down and talk with you about where he thought the analysis needed to go.
So you're kind of in the big show for securities and in corporate
exactly.
Matters
yes.
Here in the Second
yes.
Circuit. Do you remember, were there some notable cases from which you learned a lot or you know got a lot of opportunity?
Actually, the very first case I worked on when I came into the chambers was United States against Waste Management, which was a antitrust challenge to a merger case, And I just remember having hours of debate about what was the right way to determine the potential anti-competitive impact of that particular merger. And it really began a theme that ran through that entire term, that we ended up just having a lot of cases where, Ralph, because he was also interested in antitrust, had a very strong, he was very Chicago school in the sense of, in his view, the whole point of antitrust was to protect consumers. And this was still an era in which the courts were coming around to that way of thinking, but they weren't all the way there yet. And so I just remember in waste management, we were really talking about, what's best for consumers here, and how can you get there given what the statutory standards are. We had another case that was not an antitrust case, but a very similar idea, which I got a huge kick out of, the Battapaglia case, which was a case about New York's alcoholic beverage control law. And the basic issue was the interaction between the 21st Amendment and the Commerce Clause, and how much could New York regulate alcoholic beverage sales consistent with the Commerce Clause, and did the 21st Amendment just give a complete override to the Commerce Clause. And then, as luck would have it, a companion case ended up, not technically a companion case, but a case raising effectively the same issues also from New York, ended up in the Supreme Court the next year, and Justice Marshall ended up writing the majority opinion, finding parts of New York's alcoholic beverage control law to violate the Commerce Clause. So, but interestingly, it was a very similar sort of analysis, which was, how do you reconcile the state's constitutionally granted authority to limit alcoholic beverage sales with the rights, not of consumers in that state, because after all, the 21st Amendment does allow the state to regulate the sale of alcoholic beverages within its borders, but it doesn't allow it to regulate the sale of alcoholic beverages in other states. And in each case, there was a pretty decent argument that one of the real purposes of the statute was to effectively harm consumers in other states. Or certainly an effect of the statute was to harm consumers in other states. And so that ended up, again, really triggering the alarm bells that certainly went off in the winter chambers whenever you saw consumers being harmed by something that was ostensibly for their benefit.
Okay. So then that wasn't an antitrust case. It just sort of worked out with the same set of issues.
Same set of issues about consumer welfare. There was a case involving the FDA review of a medical device. I think it was called Dietronix, was the case. That similarly, the FDA seemed to have been applying its own standards for approving devices inconsistently, which once again led one to worry that the deciding factor was much more producer welfare than consumer welfare, and that again set off the alarm bells in the winter chambers.
Hmm. Now, I noticed that the Judge Winter had actually clerked for Thurgood Marshall.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Is that where the connection was made for you?
Well, I don't have any doubt, although Ralph constantly denied that he had anything to do with my getting the job. I don't believe that for a minute. I don't have any doubt that his connection to Marshall was certainly important to Marshall in hiring me, and so that was again just a tremendous piece of luck. I was the first of Ralph's clerks who ended up clerking for Marshall.
Tell me a little bit about your first day on the job, coming into the Supreme Court.
It's just overwhelming because, of course, the physical space is just so extraordinary, and I think anyone would admit, no matter how much they might sort of try to pretend otherwise, that physical space is an important part of how you relate to your task. And just being in this absolutely extraordinary building where it just seemed like every surface was either marble or mahogany, and where as a whatever I was, 25 or 6 year old law clerk, you have an office that's nicer than that of any partner at a law firm, it does make quite an impression on you. And of course you also are just surrounded by these truly extraordinary people. The other clerks are just some of the most brilliant people I've ever been around. Of course, some of them I'm still around. One of the clerks from that term, John Satir, is on our faculty. Pam Carlin, who clerked that year, was on our faculty for some years and is now on the Stanford faculty. Bill Stuntz, who unfortunately just passed away last week, or two weeks ago, was clerking for Justice Powell. He ended up on our faculty here before joining the Harvard faculty. Danny Richmond, who is on the Columbia faculty, was a clerk. John Weinberg, who is now on the Wayne State faculty, was another Marshall clerk. Rebecca Brown, who is on the USC faculty, was a Marshall clerk. So it was just an extraordinary group of people.
Sounds like you might have had the opportunity to get together and compare notes. Everybody's working for different justices.
Oh, yes, yes.
And tell me a little bit about what those conversations were like. What were the differences and the similarities that you folks would see?
The Supreme Court has been analogized to 9 law firms sharing the same space. And I think that is actually a good way of thinking about it. The clerks were very cognizant of the fact that they belonged to a specific chambers, but you ended up certainly engaging in the kinds of negotiations that lawyers engage in with one another, sometimes with the client's explicit authorization, and sometimes just as an exploratory matter to see what you might be able to take back to the client and see if there might be a deal to be had.
So you're talking about the terms by which there might be an agreement on a particular case.
Exactly. So you might know that another justice has a concern about a particular issue, and so you might say, well, if we were to write the opinion this way, would that assuage the concerns, etc.? And again, the justices themselves are having those conversations with one another, and the clerks are having them, and of course everyone understands that the clerks are agents, not principals, so the justice may or may not do what you suggest. And I think all the clerks were very good and sensible about that. Everyone kept in mind the fact that they were a law clerk and not a justice. Marshall used to have this very funny and endearing practice, which is you would, of course, also end up in the justice's own inner office talking about a particular issue with an opinion, and you might be arguing, gee, we ought to write it a different way, either because that would bring another justice on board or just because you thought that was analytically the right way to go about it. And you'd argue it back and forth. And sometimes Marshall would conclude that he'd heard enough and you were not going to change his mind. And if usually you could pick up on the nonverbal cues that he had made up his mind and further argument was going to be fruitless. But if you persisted, he would sometimes, without even looking up, just raise his arm and point to the commission that was hanging on his wall, which was a nice way of reminding you that he was the justice and you were the law clerk and he had the last word.
One would think that he may not have had the background in corporate law that someone even in your position might have had. Did you find that he would draw on yours and others' expertise in cases like that more than others?
I think when he started off on the Second Circuit, he didn't, of course, have a lot of background and maybe even not a lot of interest in corporate law, but he developed it very quickly. He actually took considerable pride at having been on the court that got the most corporate and securities cases, and having been effectively self-taught in those areas. So he didn't at all shy away from corporate and securities law cases. He really drew on his experience on the Second Circuit in those cases. He was also a tremendous admirer, although they would disagree on a lot of issues. He was a tremendous admirer of Henry Friendly. And when you got a corporate or securities case, he would invariably ask whether Friendly had written any opinions on that area. And he would often read whatever you brought to him that Friendly might have written to give him at least what he thought of as a well-informed perspective on the issue, even if he ultimately didn't end up agreeing.
Hmm. That's a lot of influence that Henry Friendly had from his position, I guess.
Absolutely.
Let's dig into some of the cases that came up, if you can remember any of those.
So the unfortunate fact is there were no securities law cases that in which the Marshall Chambers wrote that term. There were some, I think, some very interesting cases involving, I guess one might just call it economic regulation more generally, or perhaps even broader than that, just business-related cases. Mm-hmm. but not securities cases.
Had you pretty much committed to securities law, studying securities law at this point?
I was pretty sure at that point that I was transitioning out of my interest in antitrust and towards an interest in corporate and securities law. Yes. There were some interesting regulatory issues that came up that one of the things that was fun about being in the Marshall Chambers, and I can, I guess, now speak on this a little bit more than I might have been able to previously, just because of the fact that, as you know, the Marshall Chamber, the Marshall Papers have been made available to scholars broadly, so people are able to go and figure out which law clerks worked on which cases. So I'm not, I think, saying anything that's not publicly available information to say that my co-clerks, of course, Danny Richman is now a criminal law professor, and my other co-clerks were much more interested in the constitutional issues. I was the only clerk who tended to be terribly interested in the business-related mm-hmm. questions, so it was nice to be able to work on a lot of those cases. So there was, for example, a case, Exxon Corp. against Hunt, which involved whether parts of New Jersey's environmental cleanup cost recovery program were preempted by the Superfund statute. And, of course, it really just ends up being largely a question of statutory interpretation and then applying the standard rules of preemption. But it was certainly a case that was going to have a significant economic impact. And so I just remember working extremely hard on that case, thinking, you really got to get this right, because this has significant consequences for the economy. There was a case that probably had less impact because banks, I think, and their creditors could easily just react to it and figure out how to arrange the instruments they issued. But there was a case called FDIC against Philadelphia Gear, which involved whether a standby letter of credit issued by a bank against a promissory note that was collateral constituted in an insured deposit. And the majority said, no, it doesn't. It really doesn't look like the other things that the FDIC covers as an insured deposit. And Marshall decided to dissent based on the straightforward language of the statute, which seemed to count that instrument as an insured deposit, even though one might argue that that might not have been the smartest policy conclusion, but it seemed to Marshall, and I think he was absolutely right about this, to be what the statute said. And again, I genuinely think that Marshall had a real understanding of the costs associated with uncertainty. Obviously, he had a point of view about economic regulation that we would think of as a standard liberal point of view. But he didn't see any point in uncertainty as a regulatory tool. I mean, he thought you decide what to do and then you do it consistently, which I think is exactly right.
So let people know what the rules are.
Let people know what the rules are so that they can arrange their businesses with the rules in mind. And I think that was very clear in that dissent. I think it was generally clear in his approach to these regulatory cases.
Did you see him change his mind in any of these cases?
The one case in which, and again, this is a matter of public record, it's been written on, he changed his mind was there was a case about summary judgment standards in antitrust, the Matsushita case. And effectively, the idea was the plaintiffs, if I'm remembering correctly, were making a claim about anti-competitive conduct that was implausible on its face, that effectively, to believe it, you would have had to have believed that Matsushita was deliberately incurring losses over a period of decades just for some outside hope that someday they might be able to charge an anti-competitive price. And so the question is, can you grant summary judgment to the defense in a case like that? And Marshall initially concluded that you couldn't grant summary judgment there. I wrote a bench memo before the case was argued, contending that this was actually an appropriate case for summary judgment. And I, of course, cited some prior Marshall opinions as part of the basis for believing that. And of course, as you know, the judges vote in conference, so they go into their conference room and only the justices are there, and Marshall would come back from conference, and of course he would tell the clerks, here are the cases where we're in the majority, here are the cases where we're in dissent, here's the opinions we've been assigned, so you'd know how the cases were coming out. So he came back from conference and announced that plaintiffs were going to win in the Matsushita case. And but then I think it was that same evening, or maybe it was the next day, he called the chambers after going home and said essentially that on further reflection about the case, he had changed his mind and that we should inform the other chambers of it. And so he ended up being in the majority, finding that summary judgment was appropriate in the case.
How important was it that it was a private plaintiff rather than a government antitrust case?
Marshall was a former Solicitor General, as you know, and I think he had a sense from that experience that the government's views on a case like that were probably entitled to a little bit of deference, so I suspect that it being a private antitrust case did have some effect on his thinking.
Any other high points of your time working with Justice Marshall?
Well, really, the high point, I think, did not per se have to do with specific cases. The high point had to do with the fact that you were working for someone who was not merely a justice of the Supreme Court, but a true hero. Chief Justice Rehnquist, when Marshall stepped down, said, and said very astutely, that Marshall was perhaps the only person on the court, with the exception, of course, of Justice White, who would have been famous as a football player, but the only member of the court who would have been famous as a lawyer, even if he'd never sat on the Supreme Court. And of course, the Supreme Court was only the final act in what I think one could fairly say was the most extraordinary legal career of the 20th century. And one got constant reminders of that in conversation with the justice. And the...
How so?
Well, the high point, going back to the question, the high point of the clerkship was the fact that every day we would gather in the justice's office, and just, it was basically almost like a case management meeting. You would just go through where we all stood with various assignments, who was working on what, and what progress we were making, etc. But almost inevitably, at some point, something that someone said would remind Marshall of a story from his bottomless well of stories, and you would be treated to just some of the most extraordinary reminiscences that one could possibly get. I, of course, recently saw Lawrence Fishburne's play, Thurgood, and it was really just fun and a little bit chilling to hear some of the same stories coming out of Fishburne's portrayal as I had heard sitting in Marshall's chambers.
Yeah, it must be something to be that closely connected with legend.
So yes, absolutely.
Well, let's move on. You went from there to Sullivan and Cromwell?
That's right, yes.
And now it sounds as if you were, you know, sort of academically inclined. Did you intend to make a go of the practice, or what were you thinking at that point?
What I was thinking at that point was I wasn't sure whether I wanted to be an academic, but I was sure that if I ever did want to be an academic, it was going to be in corporate and securities law. And it seemed to me that that was a field in which one really needed to get practical experience, certainly to have credibility as a teacher. And so I went in really not knowing. I thought there was a possibility that this would be something I would continue to do for a full career. I thought that there was also a possibility that I might end up trying something else, whether it was working in government or working as an academic.
Okay. So tell me what kind of work you were able to do. I would assume that you'd come in as something of a generalist at the entry level of the firm.
Yes, and I think as a young lawyer, there are two strategies that one can follow. One can try to become incredibly knowledgeable and competent about a particular area that you think is going to be an important one in the practice and become sort of a go-to person on that type of transaction or issue or what have you. Or you can take what I think is a riskier but ultimately more rewarding potentially rewarding at least, tactic, which is to say, I want to stay a generalist, and I want to, I mean, I could see that at Sullivan and Cromwell and other firms at that level, there were people among the very senior ranks whom every client wanted to talk to when they had something that was just a new problem that had never really come up before. So, of course, Raj Cohen, who was recently the chairman of Sullivan and Cromwell, and Bill Williams, who was really one of the leading securities lawyers of his generation. They were folks that a client always wanted to hear what they thought about an issue that was just a new issue or for which there was just no clear answer. And that seemed to me to be the type of lawyer you really wanted to be. Someone who had a sufficiently broad scope of experience and understanding so that when there was a new problem, you were there helping figure out how to solve it.
So how'd you go about doing that?
What I did was I tried to be fairly ruthless about what assignments I took on and didn't take on. I tried very hard to do a broad range of things. So I did some securities offerings, some M&A, some bank regulatory work, some bank transactional work, a little bit of investment company work. Really tried to do as many different types of things as I could and just learn as much as I could.
You must have been spending a lot of time learning, I would think.
Yes, that was an incredibly intense period. I worked long hours.
Yeah.
Of course, my wife was working long hours too. She was at Wachtell Lipton doing M&A, so I think we both sort of understood that there was just going to be this period of our lives when we were just working insane hours, but that probably wouldn't be true our entire lives.
Mm-hmm. Any notable cases that we should talk about, particularly having to do with securities?
So what I guess one thing, a couple of things I would say. I was practicing during the relatively early days of structured finance. Of course, that became one would have never imagined that structured finance would become a household word 20 years later, but that I guess was notable, and certainly that was a period in which people were really trying to work out what was the best way to structure these deals. Similarly, my practice started at a relatively early stage in the development of the swaps market, and again, if you had told me that swaps would become a household name 20 plus years down the road, I would have been very surprised by that. But that was similarly an era in which what was then the International Swaps Dealers Association, later changed its name to International Swaps and Derivatives Association, was still really working out the documentation for swaps, and so that was an interesting, those were interesting times as well.
Were you working for the investment banks?
Most of my clients were investment banks, although I certainly represented a lot of issuers of securities and acquirers or targets in M&A deals, companies that were engaged in joint ventures or project financings of various sorts. Another thing that was just fascinating at that time, of course, is it was during Margaret Thatcher's prime ministership in the UK, so there were a lot of UK privatization transactions going on, and Sullivan and Cromwell represented the Crown or the investment banks in some of those transactions, in fact, many of those transactions. Let's see.
Did you have any interface with the SEC?
Almost nonstop, because on any transaction you were working on, obviously there'd be the routine layer of interactions with the SEC, but there were also a lot of informal conversations just to get a sense of what the staff's views were on particular issues.
Corporation finance, market reg, who would you talk to?
More often corporation finance. Mm-hmm. So one thing that was a constant theme during the period I was practicing was investment bankers trying to come up with ways of providing a little bit more liquidity to privately placed securities. So Rule 144A comes in just as I'm leaving to become an academic, but that was really a response to a buildup of pressure behind the dam, because there were increasing numbers of private deals, especially of non-US issuers. You had investment banks trying to figure out ways of providing some liquidity to the purchasers in those deals. And so you just found yourself really with angels dancing on the head of a pin, trying to figure out, well, would this be okay? Would this structure work? You'd be asking questions of people on the staff. You'd be asking questions of other lawyers. What do you think is okay here? Where are the boundary lines? And the boundary lines just weren't clear. And so, of course, it was, I think, a very important step for the SEC to come out with Rule 144A.
So you're sort of describing a series of transactions or consultations that,
right,
that informed that.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think the same thing was basically true with Regulation S, which also came down the road just as I was ending my time in practice. Similarly, there was just constant questioning in the Eurodollar market about what are the rules, and because so much of what the rules were was what one might say a common law, it was you of course had the original SEC release on the topic, and then you had what people had done and what the staff had seemed to get nervous about and what it hadn't seemed to get nervous about, and so there was a constant process of trying to figure out, as market conditions changed and bankers and issuers wanted to tweak what they'd done before, what tweaks were okay and what tweaks were not okay.
Okay. Were you still practicing when the recession 1990 hit?
My last day on the job was something around I would guess, April, May 1990. So okay. it was a little bit in the early stages of that recession.
So not seeing any fallout from your clients at that point.
No, that's right.
Tell me a little bit about the decision to go into teaching and what brought you here.
An important part of the decision to go into teaching was that so many of my former co-clerks and friends were academics. And I'd encounter them, and they would just rave about what a wonderful job this was and how much they enjoyed it. And I think both Julia, my wife, and I were reaching a stage of really having to decide, do I want to position myself for this to be what I do for the rest of my career, or do I want to try something different? And I don't know that the decision-making process was the most careful and analytical one, but we just both had this sort of gut feeling that maybe this was a good time to take a little bit of a risk and see if it panned out. So I decided to give this a try. At that stage, the hiring process was a little less formal than it is today. Today, there is this AALS job fair in Washington, D.C., and pretty much everyone goes through that. In that era, it was entirely possible to get on people's radar screens by just writing letters to the deans of law schools and saying, I'm interested in teaching, and see what would happen. So I wrote to probably about a dozen law schools, and basically all places where there was at least some tradition of strength in law and economics, because again, I knew that was going to be my research methodology, but I also knew that, unlike a lot of people who at that time and certainly later were going into the fields I was interested in, I don't have a PhD in economics. So I thought it was really essential that I go to some place where you had people who were working at the cutting edge that I could learn from. And, of course, Virginia was a very strong center for law and economics, and so that was one of the places that I was particularly interested in. And I also had friends on the faculty. Bill Stunson, Pam Carlin, whom I've mentioned, who I clerked with, were here on the faculty. Dan Ortiz, who was a year ahead of me in law school and as a law clerk, was on the faculty here. Saul Levmore, whom I'd known a little bit prior to coming down here, was on the faculty. John Jeffries, who actually had taught me criminal law as a visiting professor at Yale, was on the faculty here. So it certainly was a nice place to come and interview and get to know people. And I was just amazed at the place. I really was. It stood out really among all of the law schools that I interviewed with as a place where the faculty was just a real community. People, even though they worked in different methodologies and different substantive fields, reaching different conclusions, just all were incredibly warm and cooperative with one another. And the other thing that just astonished me was how happy the students were. I thought my law school experience at Yale was a lot of fun and interesting, and students got along well with one another. But Virginia had really taken this to another level. The students just seemed incredibly kind to one another. They seemed really remarkably close to the faculty. People were very much on a first name basis and got along with one another, and that all just struck me as being incredibly healthy. So,
I'm intrigued then by your research agenda and how it worked itself out over the last 20 years. And it's a huge subject, lots of complications, but I would like to attempt to tackle some of the high points in the next few minutes if we can. Now, had anyone using law and economics as a methodology dug as deeply into securities law in the early 1990s as you were anticipating doing? Was there someone that you could, talk to and say, this is where I want to go?
Yes. There were certainly people. I think of Dan Fischel and Frank Easterbrook as being two obvious examples of people who were really using law and economics to say important things about securities regulation. Bernie Black went into teaching just a little bit before I did, and he has some very impressive technical skills and was also working in that in that area. Same thing is true of Marcel Kahan, who also was basically entering teaching about the same time as I was. Jennifer Arlen is another person who was entering teaching just a little bit before I did and was interested. So there were people a little bit older, like Dan and Frank, and then there were people more or less of my same generation. And so there were plenty of people to talk to about how you go about doing this.
I'm going to jump around, and I'm picking on some of the subjects that I found intriguing. And if I'm missing something important, let me know. One of the first highlights is the mandatory disclosure and agency cost paper, I think, which really puts you right into the middle of the kinds of subjects you're going to look at. Where did that come from? How did you develop that interest and then build it out?
During the entire time that I was practicing, I would notice that if one were talking to staff at the SEC, they had a genuine pride in the history of their agency and the role it played in the New Deal. And that, I thought, was a very healthy thing. The SEC was... And I think still is an incredibly talented group of people. It manages to attract, I think, because of the role it played in shaping the modern securities markets, it was able to attract just extraordinarily talented people. So I thought that sense of the agency as having a past was something really positive. But there was also a negative, which was I thought that often the agency's views about its own past, or perhaps more accurately, the past of the markets and how regulation affected the markets, was a little uncritical. And so a goal that I had right from the first day I became an academic was to better understand what the markets had been like prior to the SEC, what the law had been like prior to the SEC, to understand how the securities reforms of the 1930s and the creation of the SEC affected that. And if really one might say just to do a revisionist history of the New Deal securities reforms. I think that in finance, as in war, the winners tend to write the history, and most of what I read about the 1920s and 30s and the role of securities law and the SEC seemed to be written from a somewhat triumphalist perspective, and it seemed to me that it was past time for someone to go back who didn't have a particular axe to grind and just say, what really happened? Mm-hmm. And one of the first things that struck me as I did that was how much of the basic framework of the 33 Act in particular had been anticipated in prior law. And that was really the origin of that particular paper.
Okay. And the point being that the prior law was informed by the needs of the sort of the industry as it existed, and sort of the dominant players in the industry in those previous years.
Yes, and I think it was attentive to the persistent principal agent problems that, in some sense, are the root issue that one deals with everywhere in corporate and securities law. Mm-hmm. And I thought prior law was quite attentive to the existence of those problems. And indeed, one of the big messages of the paper is that I think that subsequent scholars and regulators perhaps lost a little bit of track of that and read into the 33 Act something that hadn't really been there at its outset, which was this idea that regulators could help people figure out what price to pay for a security, which I just didn't think of as being part of the original plan. I think the original plan was that you were going to inform investors thoroughly about all of the myriad conflicts of interest that might lie beneath the surface of a transaction that they were considering, but whether this was a good deal or not on the merits was really not going to be a concern of the regulatory system.
Now, this is something you came back to with your political economy of the 33 Act,
right,
which is essentially that's really the same concept.
Right.
There's a few years between those, but do you see those as being part of the same overall project?
Yes, and the second paper just added on something to the first. The first really asked about what the law was and wasn't, and the second paper thought a little bit more about the institutional structure of securities regulation, both from the industry side and the regulatory side. So it really asked the question, did the existence of the SEC and the 33 Act affect the way in which the industry went about its business, and were they in turn able to shape the way the regulatory system worked in order to serve their own interests? Because it seems to me that's got to be the first question or an early question you ask about any regulatory system, is we all think about the regulators acting on the industry, but I think you also have to ask, how does the industry act on the regulators, and does that ultimately provide benefits or costs to the ultimate consumers or investors, as the case may be?
This is sort of like a case of regulatory capture, but maybe regulatory co-optation, I guess.
Yes, yes. And then I wrote a subsequent paper about the blue sky laws that, right, that had the same underlying task, which is to say, did the industry manage to get some of what it wanted from these reforms? And was that a good thing or a bad thing for investors?
Tell me a little bit about the research process here. I mean, you weren't necessarily trained as a historian, but you're
right,
doing all kinds of historical work here. What kinds of sets of information would you use for the, say, the Blue Sky Law project?
What I would typically do is start with primary legal materials. That is to say, the statutes, the legislative history. In a number of states around the time of the Blue Sky Laws, there were various sorts of legislative hearings or commissions that were put in place to try to investigate the industry. So I would look at those records. I would look at contemporary press accounts. And although this is very hit and miss because you didn't have industry groups that were quite as well organized as they are today, if you could find documents from industry groups. So certainly in the 33 Act paper, there was an organization of investment bankers, and they had an annual convention, and people would give speeches, and you'd see the transcripts of those, and that was really very useful in trying to get a sense of what the industry was thinking and trying to imply from that what its strategy might be in dealing with legislatures who were clearly interested in creating some sort of reform legislation. So that would all be a piece of it. And then the question is always, is there systematic data that you can come up with? So for the 33 Act paper, I knew that there had been an antitrust suit against the investment banking industry in the late 1940s or 1950s. In fact, Sullivan and Cromwell had represented some of the investment banks in that, so I knew a little bit about that litigation. And it turned out that our library here at UVA had some of the documents that were produced in that litigation. There were other documents that were at other law school libraries. And even Sullivan and Cromwell had a few bits and pieces of the record remaining. So from that, I concluded that one could put together not a 100% comprehensive, but certainly a reasonably comprehensive look at the underwritings that were done prior to the SEC and then after the SEC, and say something useful about what was happening in the market share of the major investment banks in underwriting.
Okay. Something that was a little bit of a departure from those are all sort of working in the same area, and this is an article that's been cited a lot, is the Exchange as Regulator article.
Mm-hmm.
Does that fit in with this overall research program, or is it somehow different?
It's a little bit different because But I think in the same vein. So what's different about it is instead of saying, here's what the law and framework looked like before the securities laws versus afterwards, instead it's a little bit more of a thought experiment saying, let's pretend for a minute we didn't have the securities laws. What do we think we would have? What kind of structures would ordinary principles of corporate law, contract law, property law, etc., plus extrapolation from what we know the industry was doing to regulate itself before the securities laws, what would that produce and what would that look like? So I think of it as being in service of the same basic idea, which is to, in a sense, compare the world without the regulatory system we have to the world with it, but here engaging in a little bit more of hypothetical reasoning.
Right. And given that, 15 years on, are you surprised by some of the things that you've seen, or what are the factors in the structure of the markets that you never anticipated when you were doing that work?
Well, certainly technology has opened up a variety of trading platforms that really don't look much like traditional exchanges. And I think the SEC has been right to spend a lot of time thinking about that and how the regulatory system ought to deal with that.
Yeah, and some of that was just emerging.
That's right. That's right. It was very early days, yes.
Terrific. Any other academic subjects that we should talk about before we sort of wrap up?
No, I think I'm still really working to the extent I can with my current administrative duties on bits and pieces of what the pre-SEC markets looked like and how things changed once the regulatory system came into being. So I know that's going to be an ongoing interest. I'm hoping once I step down from this job to be able to look more at what's happened in the last decade, from Sarbanes-Oxley through Dodd-Frank, and with luck, by the time I'm done here, one will be able to look at before and after data and be able to say something useful about them.
And you'll be at a bit more of a historical remove as well.
So exactly. I think it's very hard to talk about these things when passions are still running high. I don't think that tends to produce the most careful analytical work.
Well, something I'd love to just kind of wrap up with is your perspective on the business of teaching law and how the students and the professors have changed over the years. One of the points that one could take as a comparison is, you know, that came in at a point where the law and economics movement was fairly new and there was a lot of vibrancy. What are you seeing now that reminds you of that?
I think the behavioral psychology people are probably at a stage a lot like the stage law and economics was at when I went into teaching. They are able to say a lot of interesting and new things, and I also think that there's a focus at the moment on the low-hanging fruit, and as that field matures, they're going to have to get more systematic in developing a kind of a broader perspective on how everything fits together.
Corporate insecurities law, are you seeing continued interest in that?
Oh, absolutely. Because the students remain very interested in it, and as a consequence, I think it's actually a great field for a young academic to go into. An awful lot of the people who go into academic life travel a path that I think will tend to push one into constitutional law, administrative law, criminal law, etc. So I think there's a lot of room for talented would-be academics to make a name for themselves in corporate and securities law.
Well, terrific. Anything else we should talk about?
I think that's good.
Great. Thanks very much.
Sure. You're very welcome.